You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Hello again. Time for another edition of the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you for joining us this morning. With me in the studio is the always imitated, never duplicated David Moxley on the board with me. And good morning, Stupid.
Well, good morning, Dr. Stupid. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I guess we're all stupid now.
Hey, if you wore that little badge of pride that said I voted, the little peach badge, you know?
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess they're going to have to put a big red mark across it that says I'm stupid.
Right. I think we need to change the sticker to I'm a stupid Georgia voter, thanks to the brilliant insights of one Dr. Jonathan Gruber, the, quote, brilliant economic person at MIT, who has revealed to us that that lack of transparency in government is the way to deal with the stupidity of the American voter. Such a wonderful thing we have going on.
Yeah, his statement was just compounded by what Obama had said earlier about the loss, and that was, you know, that he heard the third that voted, and he also heard the two-thirds that didn't vote.
Sure. That makes perfect sense in the American system, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The wisdom that I was raised on is that if you don't vote, then you don't have the right to complain. And if you forfeit intentionally your right to have your voice heard, then you're not supposed to be listened to, because that is your civic duty to vote. But that's fine. Obama can hallucinate that there's a whole bunch of people that, had they voted, that he would still be, in charge and on top. But, that's just kind of an unfortunate thing. Anyhow, a couple of housekeeping items at the front end of the show. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by Docs for Patient Care Foundation, a 501c3 organization that promotes freedom of choice in healthcare. I also want to begin with a shout-out to the Technology Association of Georgia, and a bit of a personal note. They have bestowed on me the honor and the privilege of becoming a member of the Technology Association of Georgia Healthcare Board of Advisors. And that is a very vibrant section of the Technology Association of Georgia, the health section. It's a very vibrant group, and it is staffed by some very, very active, pleasant, vibrant people, and I look forward to working with them. There is an event coming up called the Health IT Leadership Summit on November 20th, and I look forward to being there and meeting some folks at least in the evening. Now, my first mission, I think, as a new member of that board of advisors will be to shame and coerce and cajole some of my new fellow board members into to listening to the show, and maybe even get some of you, if you're listening this morning, to invite you to be a guest on the show one of these days. So it turns out that whole tag thing is perfect timing, because today we're going to talk about the results of the recent midterm elections as they affect the health information technology community. And for those of you who have been living under a rock for the past 6 months, we had midterm elections last week. And in those elections, the supporters of big government were handed their heads on a silver platter, with crushing defeats not only in the House and in the Senate, but in many state gubernatorial races and many state legislative delegations. Many have called this the biggest defeat for the supporters of big government in decades. I think, David, correct me if I'm wrong, the official Senate pickup now for the Republicans goes to 8 from 7, correct, with the victory of Dan Sullivan in Alaska, which, of course, Alaska takes several days to get all those votes from far outreach places back into the Capitol. This is a big deal for the health information technology community as well. You heard last week my co-host Dr. Hal Schertz and Dr. Jeffrey English, the president of the Georgia chapter for Docs for Patient Care, discuss some of the more mainstream consequences of the recent midterm elections. Today we're sort of going to look at it from the health information technology standpoint. And again, this is not going to be a boring technical conversation about bits and bytes. This is going to be good stuff, so stick around. And again, we circle back to sort of set the mood to these comments from MIT professor and Obamacare mastermind Jonathan Gruber, who made not one, not two, but three, now we have documented on video, three sets of comments, all of which basically said the same thing, that the Obamacare bill, the 2,000 and some odd page Obamacare bill, was intentionally written in a tortured way, that's his words, a tortured way to make this thing difficult to understand and to intentionally deceive the Congressional Budget Office into scoring the bill incorrectly so that its costs would be read and reported as lower as they truly would be. And we have certainly seen that in the years since Obamacare has been passed, that this has gone from an under $1 trillion bill to something that's upwards of pushing $3 trillion. So, of course, the truth was delayed until it was too late and the votes were taken. He also says that lack of transparency is a huge political advantage because of the stupidity of the American voter. So that's why this morning David is officially stupid and I'm officially Dr. Stupid and all of you out there who voted are all also officially stupid, according to the government, and that we really don't deserve to have a say in things, that really the way the world should be structured is the way that big government folks like to have it with, the government people, the ruling elite, the divinely inspired rulers running the show. And so in a nutshell, you have an excellent portrayal of what big government thinks about the people that it's supposed to serve, not to rule, but to serve, that you're too stupid to know better, right? We have the right to lie to you and mislead you because what we say goes because we're just a whole lot smarter than you, the people. And to circle this back into health information technology, we see manifestations of this attitude within the government's position towards health information technology, and even in this unholy alliance called Meaningful Use, or the high-tech EMR incentive program, we see health information technology community and the government pairing up and sort of facing physicians, facing the healthcare community with pretty much the same attitude, which is that doctors are not smart enough to make their own decisions about how to use health information technology in their practice. We're going to force physicians to do this with incentives and then ultimately Medicare-based penalties if you don't employ health information technology in your practice the way the government says you're supposed to do. You're just supposed to shut up, sign the contract with your EMR vendor, cut the six-figure check, sit down, and just let them work their so-called miracles. And sadly, for the 5 years or 4 or 5 years that Meaningful Use has been around, this appears to have worked if you look at the statistics for EMR implementation, which went from about 4% in 2008 to well over 50% now, with some 500,000 plus providers having signed up for at least the first year of the Meaningful Use program. However, the times are changing now. We've had a midterm election, and we've had a change in the balance of power, and the big government supporters that pushed this stuff through as a part of the stimulus bill in the first place are not in charge of the House. They're no longer in charge of the Senate, and we're going to, I think, see a very different change in the climate regarding health information technology. Now the fear is that the Republicans, having been handed a golden opportunity to fix things over at least the next 2 years, are going to squander this opportunity. And this is certainly not an original thought. This is certainly not my thought. We've heard this, many places, that the Republicans now in charge lack a vision. They lack a concerted message. They lack a concerted purpose. And my thought to you this morning is that the health information technology community is going to have the same problem very soon. Because for the last 4 or 5 years of Meaningful Use, the health information technology community has not had to have a message, has not had to have a strategy. Why? Because the government is forcing their customers to buy their products. So if you're in a situation where you don't need to perform, you don't need to demonstrate value in your products, and the government's forcing other folks, your would-be customers to become true customers, there's really no point in making those people happy, because in reality, thanks to Meaningful Use, the government is the customer to the health IT community, not the physicians, and certainly not the patients. And so, the message, if there's any, from the health information technology community to healthcare providers, to physicians, is just shut up, relax, and enjoy the ride. We've got the government on our side. There's nothing that you can do about it. And so there's really been no need for the health information technology community to have any sort of vision regarding its own products, any sort of vision regarding, what the future is supposed to look like, except you keep cutting the checks, you keep signing the contracts, and we just make, a ton of money. But things are changing, right? Last week, the meaningful use program actually took a double whammy, and the midterm elections was only one of the pieces of bad news for meaningful use. The other was some data that was released by CMS for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services released some devastating data regarding the performance of meaningful use. So listen to some of these numbers. Now, meaningful use is broken up into stages, right? You have stage one, which is basically buy your EMR, plug it in, and do a bunch of things, most of which don't make any sense, just to sort of get your EMR up and running. And, you know, when the bar was that low, strangely enough, the payments were the highest. And under that structure, there were about 500,000 providers out of a possible probably 1 million or so eligible providers who met the requirements for the first year of stage one, stage one, year one. And that sounds like a good start. And of course, they were trumpeting this and saying that, you know, yes, doctors are finally learning the wisdom and wonderfulness of health information technology. That's not really true. It just shows that if you make a carrot big enough and a stick big enough, you can make the mule move. Even if you're pushing the mule straight towards the edge of a cliff, if the carrot's big enough and the stick's big enough, the mule's going to go over the edge. So 500,000 out of a possible 1 million, that's pretty good, except that from year one to year two of meaningful use, there was a 17% attrition rate. So out of that 500,000, do the math, probably only less than 400,000 signed up for the second year. And now that we've gotten to the fourth year, the attrition rate is now about 90%. So we've gone from 500,000 participants for stage one, year one, down to about 40,000, maybe 43,000 providers signing up in 2014. And 2014 was the first year of stage two of meaningful use, right? We have stage one, stage two, and, you know, stage three is still, you know, in the planning stages. Hopefully it doesn't get any farther than that. But the rate of participation in stage two, David, is a whopping 2%. So we've gone from over 50% down to 2%, and the total meaningful use payments in 2014 were only 5% of what they were the year before. Now, part of that's hardwired into the payment schedule, which drops. But still, there is a huge drop in participation as this program is supposed to progress, and obviously that wasn't a part of their plan. So, and as if that's not enough, right? We have providers deserting meaningful use in droves. The meaningful use money is also running out. The original allocation for meaningful use was somewhere around $30 billion. Of that $30 billion, $25 billion has been spent to pay providers and cover admin costs. And so that's going to run out. And the new Congress, the Republican-controlled Congress, is unlikely to, or at least far less likely than a Democratic-controlled Senate, is far less likely to be able to, you know, re-up that program and put more money into it. So I think when the existing allocated money is gone, this program's going to be done. And so we're seeing, you know, folks kind of desert this program. The American Medical Association, certainly not a big fan of theirs, but they have requested that CMS eliminate all of the Medicare penalties that would result from failing to meet meaningful use requirements. So you think that's enough, David? We got some more. As if that's not enough, the leadership of the meaningful use program, the Office of the National Coordinator of Information Technology, was once staffed by a very dynamic person, Dr. Mostashari, who was a big supporter. He's gone. His replacement, Karen DeSalvo, MD, she's going to be gone, and her second in command, Jacob Ryder, MD, is going to be gone. And so now the AMA and HIMSS, the group that sort of, you know, covers health information technology, is now worried that there's going to be a big leadership gap. So we got providers running away from meaningful use, we've got the leadership running away from meaningful use, and we have the money for meaningful use running out. We'll pick this up in segment two. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Stay put. That's an order.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is Dr. George. Join me Wednesday mornings for Medicine on Call and participate in a lively conversation. Learn what's happening behind the headlines in medicine. Understand Obamacare. And learn how to protect yourself and navigate the system.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning at 8 a.m. and listen to The Doctor's Lounge, where you get a private insight into the conversations that doctors have amongst themselves. Join us Thursday, 8 a.m. every week.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is a special week on The Doctor's Lounge because in celebration, in recognition of Jonathan Gruber's comments regarding the stupidity of the American voter, we are calling the show today the show where stupid people come to listen to what doctors think and what doctors talk about. So David and I here were talking about the midterm elections, and we were talking about the effect this is going to have on the health information technology community, and we had talked about how meaningful use looks like it's going to be pretty much on a tailspin straight into the ground. Meaningful use, for those of you not familiar with it, is the government's incentive program designed to coerce and intimidate physicians in the United States into adopting health information technology before it's really ready for prime time. And so that's our topic for today. Back in 2008, the leaders and the CEOs of the large EMR vendors all got together and cut a deal with the Obama administration in some sort of proverbial smoke-filled room and decided that the health information technology community needed a stimulus program of its own, and it was created. It was called the HITECH program, or the Meaningful Use program. And armed with regulations that force providers to purchase electronic medical records, health IT vendors had no need to have a message, had no need to make their products any good, because their customers were being forced to buy them. But with a combination of bad news in the midterm elections for these folks and a combination of bad news from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services regarding the statistics on meaningful use that we reviewed at the end of the last segment, the meaningful use program, I think the days are numbered. And I think it's important for the health information technology community to recognize that and prepare itself because, the health information technology community is not going to do well unless it comes up with a new strategy and a new message to actually engage the healthcare community as opposed to engaging the government. Because I think the days of government participation is going to run out. And so what is it that I think the health information technology needs to do? Well, right now they are a community which, and again, I don't mean to paint an overly broad brush. I mean, the folks that I work with face-to-face in health information technology are terrific people. And, guys and ladies, you know who you are. The folks that I'm working with on a regular face-to-face basis are terrific people, and I think you guys are great. So these are, the comments I'm about to make regarding the arrogance of the health information technology community is based on what I have seen in more distant locations than my own world, with the exception of one example that I will come up with at the end. But I think the health information technology community is arrogant in its position regarding its potential customers, physicians and other healthcare providers, and I think they are ignorant of what we in the healthcare community need from health information technology. So if you don't believe me or you think that's an overstatement, let's check out some examples. And I kind of gathered up numerous examples here to review that go all the way back to 2008 and come all the way up to yesterday. So we'll start the list. So here's number one.
This was a meeting of a user group that deals with our EMR, which is a centricity project from GE. This was a users group meeting, and I was meeting people and shaking hands and kissing babies and doing all that kind of stuff. And I met a health information technology person, and we were talking about electronic prescriptions, which back in 2008 were in their infancy. And this person bragged to me and said, yeah, you know, I went to a doctor once and we got through the whole visit, and then he went to give me a prescription and he pulled out a paper prescription pad. And I walked out on the spot, this person tells me. I walked out on that doctor on the spot after an otherwise good visit, because if he is not smart enough to handle electronic prescriptions, then he must not be a very smart doctor if he can't handle something that simple. So I walked out on him. I'm very proud to tell this story. And again, this was 2008, right? This was 6 years ago, and electronic prescriptions was in its infancy, and very few people were using them. Not like today, where basically we're all using it. But again, the arrogance of this person, you know, really stuck with me, because here I am, you know, 6 years later, still talking about it. Example number two. Is a meeting called the mHealth Summit, the Mobile Health Summit. This happens in Washington, D.C. every year in December. The next meeting is coming up. In 2011, which I think was the fifth year this meeting was held, the keynote speakers were Kathleen Sebelius, right, who was the director of HHS at the time. She resigned this past January. And one Dr. Eric Topol, who is regarded by many in the health information technology community as kind of a patron saint of health information technology. And these two keynote speakers got up at this meeting in 2011 in Washington, D.C., and just bashed the daylights out of physicians, bashed the daylights out of the healthcare community. Kathleen Sebelius says, and I quote, "Healthcare has stubbornly hung on to its cabinets and hanging files." And that statement's pathetic for two reasons. One is, we're not doing it, or we weren't doing it because we were stubborn. We're doing it because we're cautious. And the second part of that quote that actually makes you laugh is that we didn't store paper charts in hanging file cabinets. That's not how charts are stored. So paper charts are stored. So clearly, Ms. Sebelius had never seen the inside of a doctor's office beyond perhaps the waiting room, the exam room, because she didn't even know how paper charts were handled, and she sort of gave away her ignorance. So that was kind of funny and pathetic all at the same time. And Dr. Topol, a fellow physician, kind of deserted deserted his colleagues, if you will, by his comments, where he said that, you know, doctors are very much set in their ways, and he referred to the healthcare community with the word ossified. Now, ossified is kind of a medical term. It means something that's turned to stone or turned to bone. Ossified means it used to be made of something else. Now it's calcified. It's a statue. It's dead. The term ossified was not complimentary, but this was a very disappointing thing for me to read about. I didn't go to that meeting, but I read about it in an article a couple of weeks later. And so, you know, we've got folks, you know, bashing the people that they're trying to sell their products to. Example number three, at a health IT meeting that I went to in Atlanta last year, roughly a year ago, there was a keynote speaker who was extolling the virtues of mobile health, mHealth. This is health on your smartphone, or these days a wearable technology, which we're going to get into. And he was, you know, talking about how wonderful this stuff is. And that part's pretty good, because I really think there's a lot of potential there. But then he suggested, you know, how are you going to sell this to physicians? And here's what he said. He said, tell your doctors, tell your customers that they can, you can sell this to them by telling them that they can practice medicine from the golf course, that they can monitor a patient's blood sugar from the golf course, they can monitor a patient's blood pressure from the golf course. And isn't that great? And I thought, wow, this is good. All right, here's a keynote speaker at a major health information technology meeting who still hasn't figured out who doctors are and what we do, and that the stereotype, the cliche of doctors playing golf on Wednesday afternoons is long gone. I don't even know anybody. I don't know any doctors who play golf. All the people I know who play golf are lawyers or other professionals. They're the ones that have time to do it. Doctors, because we have to work so much harder to produce the same amount of money than we did 20, 25 years ago. I mean, we don't golf. I can't remember the last time I actually golfed with a physician. The last time I played golf, nobody in the group was a physician, and it was 2 or 3 years ago. My golf clubs are gathering dust in the cabinet. So this is a little news flash to anybody in health information technology who's listening. If you come to my office and you try to sell me on your product based on the notion that I can go play more golf, I'm going to escort you to the front door and throw you out on your ear, because it means you have no clue who I am as a physician or what I need from health information technology.
You know, Michael, it's something that strikes me of what you just said from the meetings that you've gone to, and it's across the board. As you know, we have a number of different shows, not just medicine, many different shows, and they all have there's a focal point with all of it. It's the people that are dictating have no clue. They're not, you know, if they're doctors, they're not practicing doctors that are trying to make these laws or trying to make the, just like what you were saying, and Sibelius, she had no clue about anything.
No.
But the doctor that you mentioned, and with their arrogant attitude, they come in and they tick off the people they're trying to work with.
Exactly. I mean,
this doesn't make any sense.
Why bash your target audience,
yeah,
David? I don't understand that. I don't know, and that's part of what I'm going to get to at the end of the
medicine.
Show.
It's in medicine. It's in every area that they've gone into.
Oh, sure. Well, medicine is a particular flashpoint among politicians because, you know, doctors have a huge amount of power. I mean, we control the purse, in theory at least, for, you know, a sixth of the budget. The decisions we make decides where money goes in order to treat patients, and politicians can't stand that. You know, they covet the power that we have access to and that the resources we have access to, even though we have legitimately earned that through, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of education beyond high school. They just can't stand the thought. So, you know, medicine ends up being a battleground. But the list goes on, David. You know, let's go back to the Ebola thing briefly. And we discussed this a little bit 2 weeks ago, the last time I was here. If you remember the patient who went to the Texas hospital, who went in, reported their travel history, it was entered in the electronic medical record system, which is an Epic system, which is the top seller, the highest market share for electronic medical records is a vendor called Epic. The information was entered into the Epic system by somebody up front. That information was not readily available to the decision makers, the folks who were actually treating that patient, and so that patient was inappropriately discharged from the hospital. You know, the rest of the story, we remember he got sicker, he came back to the hospital, he didn't survive, unfortunately.
No, the rest of the story is, did you hear yesterday, a Presbyterian is paying out the family to keep them, you know.
Oh, no, I didn't hear that.
To settle with them instead of having a lawsuit, Presbyterian now is paying them handsomely, I'm sure.
Sure, and do you think that since the electronic medical record system is a part of that, you think that Epic's going to step forward and say, hey, you know, we had a part in this? I doubt it very much. But the bottom line is they did have a part in it. And again, the mistake itself, which is a failure of the data system to put that stuff in front of the decision makers at the right time, isn't so much the problem in my eyes as, again, their arrogance in, number one, proclaiming ahead of time to doctors, we got this. We have all these problems solved. You know, clinical decision support is one of the things they brag about the most. And yet here's a situation where, you know, all it took, it didn't take some fancy protocol. All it would have taken was to put pertinent positive data in front of the clinician at the right time. Nothing fancy, but it could have made a difference in the outcome.
I mean, is this, you know, the old saying, garbage in, garbage out. But if the information had been inputted, so then it's the system itself that failed, right?
Yeah, in my opinion, it's the system itself that failed. But see, Epic doesn't own up to that, right? They rounded up their experts and they threw the hospital under the bus and said, oh, no, it wasn't our system. It was the fact that the hospital set it up wrong. In other words, they didn't configure their screens to put that stuff up at the right time. And my response to that is, well, where were you, vendor? Where were you, Epic, when they were doing this install?
Don't you know, a program like this would be installed by the vendor.
By the vendor, or at least working hand in hand with the hospital, right? I mean, one of two things had to happen. Either Epic was involved in this mistake, or they just, you know, cut the check and they collected their, you know, eight-figure check and walked away and left the hospital to fend for itself. Either way, you know, I think they have some culpability here, and yet again, arrogance, ignorance. They have no interest in participating that way, and that makes the whole situation worse for everybody else. We are at the end of segment two. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
With all the back and forth in today's politics, it seems as though the Constitution gets lost in the mix. If you want to brush up on your Constitution, then join Michael Conley every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. for the show Our Constitution on AmericasWebRadio.com.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I am here in the studio with David Moxley running the board. We're having a nice chat this morning. We are living the dream here on America's Web Radio. We are talking about the health information technology community and the new reality that the health information technology community is going to have to face. Number one, as a result of the midterm elections and the virtual disappearance of much of their support in Congress for things like a meaningful use program and other incentives that force providers, force physicians to buy inferior products or products that don't work as well as they are advertised to work. And that's really the problem. I think it's the difference between the unrealistic expectations that the health information technology community puts out there and says, hey, docs, our products are great. They're perfect. They are without fault. They're flawless. Even when they do make a mistake, we blame it on somebody else. And the reality, which is that health information technology in the healthcare setting is a poorly understood science. It's in its infancy. We don't understand the forces at work. And that's what leads to mistakes that led to the inappropriate discharge of an Ebola patient in Texas. They got sicker at home and came back to the hospital and, didn't survive. And yes, the health information technology piece of that story is important. And it demonstrates, not that healthcare vendors, health information technology vendors are evil because their products are imperfect. It does demonstrate that they are arrogant because they portray their products as perfect on the front end, and then when something happens, they refuse to take the blame or refuse to participate. They refuse to say something like, look, we are committed. I wish Epic had said this. Instead of saying, this is not our fault at all, and rounding up their experts to say that, they should have said, look, this is a tragic thing. Health information technology was a part of it. We are committed to understanding how these errors occur and see that they never happen again, and we're going to work hand in hand with our customers across the board and redouble our efforts to really understand what's happening. That would have been the right thing to say, David, but sadly they didn't.
Why do I see a gigantic cover-up coming? And now the Ebola thing, we know what happened there because that was on national television. Here's
correct.
A guy with Ebola in Dallas, Texas.
Right, already in the spotlight.
But poor Ms. Smith over here dies because there was a mistake in her EMR.
Mm-hmm.
We don't hear about Ms. Smith dying. She just died.
Oh, there's potential. That's happening every day all over the place. And yes, it doesn't hit the spotlight. The only reason we're hearing about this one is because it was in the spotlight already,
right,
because of who it was and the disease that he had.
So how, in your mind, how could we, I don't want to say Trey, how could we find this information out? How can we, because it's my life, your life, your family's life.
It's impossible. It's impossible. I think the only thing that you can do as a patient is be sure that you be your own advocate, or if you're too sick to do that, that your family is a strong advocate and really, maintains a heightened state of awareness when you're getting care. And don't assume that just because
you know, that bag of IV medicine that's getting hung on the pole next to your loved one, you know, has a fancy computer printed label on it, that doesn't mean that the label's correct. You know, read it, check the name, you know, do all those things that, you know, may feel like you're being obnoxious, but, you know, be sure that that's all getting done. And, you know, sure, I mean, you could say that, you know, the family members of this guy should have come forward maybe and said, hey, he's been to Africa. Are you sure that he's not sick? You know, and I'm not saying it's their fault at all, but, you know, in a response to your question, which is an excellent question, is that, you know, stay aware, stay vigilant. I mean, because, you know, computers make mistakes.
Will doctors have any monitoring, or will they monitor and say, I had this information, but I should have had this information?
Well, I tell you what we do in our practice, and since I write the code for what gets displayed where, we are constantly talking about that. And I am constantly looking for, you know, imperfections, mistakes, things to do. You know, when we designed our own Ebola protocol, and I wrote some code week before last, to document, you know, because we're screening patients, of course. We're asking them about travel and fever symptoms and all that kind of stuff. And it's actually a far more daunting question than it appears on the front end, because there's two pieces to it. One is to document negative results, right? You don't have a history of travel, you don't have a fever or GI symptoms. And documenting that, that's really the place the EMR comes in. And then to figure out what the heck are you going to do if somebody comes in who's positive on the screen. And figuring out those...
Run like hell?
Well, you can. I mean, that's. But it tell you what, though, David. If you don't plan, that's what happens. Is if there is no guidance, right? Which is what we saw from the CDC, was a distinct lack of guidance. If there is no guidance, that's what people are going to do. And I don't care how altruistic a provider you are, if no one provides you with a plan, I mean, it's like a fire drill. It's like any other sort of, you know, instant disaster that's in your face. Is you got to ask yourself what you're going to do and have that planned out ahead of time. So, yeah, we went to a considerable amount of effort, as I presume most, you know, all practices did, especially in Atlanta, where we got the busiest airport in the world just a few miles across town. I mean, there's plenty of people coming in who could potentially be infected, that you have to decide ahead of time what you're going to do and decide ahead of time what the limited role is for your health information system. You know, we talked about, you know, putting bells and whistles in there that said, you know, if somebody clicks the yes button for travel, that it sends flags and emails to, you know, everybody in the system. And then we decided, you know what, that's dumb. You know, that is not something that you should expect your health information system to do. You know, if there is a positive result, if the person asking the questions or looking at our paper intake form sees yes to both questions, then you don't even bother keying it in the EMR. You immediately go to the response, which is to put them in a room, isolate them, get the protective gear, and make the phone call to infection control. That was our protocol. That's still our protocol. And we talked about it as recently as last night. We had a meeting in our practice and said, well, what are we going to want to do with Ebola? It looks like it's died out, right? It looks like, you know, right now we've not only gotten rid of the last known case of Ebola in the United States, which was that physician that was cared for at Montefiore in New York, but as of today, David, we've also passed the 21-day incubation period for everybody that that person could have exposed. So at this instant, and again, this could change with the next flight that comes in, there's nobody with Ebola in the United States, and there's nobody who's at risk for getting Ebola if you accept a 21-day incubation period as the number. So our question last night, like 12 hours ago, was what do we do what do we do with our Ebola protocols? Do we, you know, all that code I wrote for putting it in the system, we just get rid of it and erase it and delete it? And we decided as a group, no, that's not going to happen because flights are still coming in. So, you know, this stuff requires active management from physicians and administrators, you know, almost on a daily basis. And, you know, the information system has to be playing the right role, not too much, not too little. And, you know, that's the part that just gets, you know, lost in many situations.
I'll just interject
yes.
This one thing. I don't think it's gone away. But with that being said, the spotlight's just been taken off of it momentarily, or the camera has been taken off of it. which is your office doesn't have a direct line to Africa. You don't know exactly hour by hour what's going on, nor does anybody else.
Correct.
So, and we all rely on the media, and we rely on the government to tell us the truth. Oops, I said something
wrong. They can't
wrong.
Tell us the truth, David. Why can't they tell us the truth? Because we're stupid.
That's right.
Remember that?
And,
so.
You know, and my concern is, quite honestly, and I would love to have a camera. We should have a camera on it, our military that's over there. We're not hearing anything.
Oh, I'm sure. And I'm sure that that's no accident. You know, it's a widespread problem. We've got, now I've talked about the arrogance of the health information technology community, and I've gotten more examples. I just can't get to them all. But suffice it to say, I could fill up the rest of the show, probably the rest of the day, with stories about, you know, how these folks behave towards physicians, both, you know, in the media and personally. But let's talk about sort of the ignorance. Let's talk about the lack of connectivity, if I can steal a term from information technology, the lack of connectivity between health information technology vendors and the people that they're supposed to be serving, which is doctors and patients. So here's a couple of examples. I pulled these off of, websites, you know, yesterday, 48 hours ago. 24 hours ago. One is from mHealth News, right? This is the publication online for mobile health, right? This is health apps for your smartphone, wearable apps, Fitbits, that kind of thing. And this was an article that quoted the CEO of a company called MedLive in San Francisco, one Randy Parker, who is not a physician. And that's a big deal, because this is written about an interview with a person who is a CEO, not a physician, and this person is lecturing physicians about bedside manner in a telehealth setting. So this is now a new situation. Instead of me being in an exam room with a patient face-to-face, you know, we're doing a Skype or we're doing a GoToMeeting type thing where that patient's on the other side of a computer screen and you're not in the same place. And he's talking about, you know, how about half of physicians, and I don't know where they get that number, how did they measure this was half and not 25% and not 90%, half of all physicians don't have a good, what did he call it, a desktop manner, you know, a bedside manner through the computer screen, and was talking about all the skills that doctors need to have in order to do telehealth. And I'm reading this thinking, well, what the hell kind of expertise does a non-physician CEO have? They may be exposed to it, but I went to this company's website. They have doctors. They have a medical director. You know, why aren't they putting the doctors out front in these articles to give them some credibility, right? If I was reading this article and it was a doctor who was saying, yeah, I've cared for 100 patients over a telehealth setting, and here's what I've learned. Here's the mistakes I've made. You know, here's an episode that didn't go well. Here's an episode that went well. I mean, that's how we docs communicate with each other, is we talk about what we learned, what our learning curve was like, and we're very straightforward about it because we want people to learn from our experiences, from the things that we don't do well from a telehealth bedside manner standpoint, for example. But you never heard from the docs. You know, why was it a CEO? Well, it was probably an ego thing. They didn't want to put the docs out front. But, you know, one thing these companies have to learn is that they do have to put their physicians out front if they're going to have any credibility with the customer base they serve. So here's another example. This is written by one Lee Kim, who is listed on HIMSS, right? HIMSS is the Health Information Management System Society. That's sort of the parent organization of health information technology vendors. HIMSS is the acronym. And this Lee Kim is listed as being the Director of Privacy and Security. And there was an article that she had in HIMSS online this past week talking about privacy and security. And saying that, here's a quote, in order to prevent a breach of your defenses, doctor, in order to prevent a breach of your defenses and preventative tactics, they need to be right 100% of the time. And so, you know, they're talking about this utopian perfection where, you know, we have in our practices unlimited time and resources to make everything perfect from a security standpoint 100% of the time. I mean, this article reads like Soviet Union propaganda. This is like utopian dream. You know, we can't connect to this. Doctors can't relate to that because, you know, nothing in medicine is 100%. We don't have treatments that are 100% effective. We don't have operations that are 100% safe. And so when you start talking about things having to be right 100% of the time, that's not practical. And if health IT security products are that unforgiving, And that difficult to use, that, you know, we're getting breaches all the time, right? Inside and outside of medicine. Clearly, security technology is not where it needs to be, right? Breaches at Home Depot, breaches at Target, breaches at various medical sites. And so to suggest that there's a utopia where we're all going to do things right 100% of the time and fix the security problem isn't realistic. And again, these companies are clueless, they're ignorant, and doctors aren't going to listen. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. This is your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak. I alternate Thursdays with my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz. He will be on next week. We are so glad that you have stayed with us to the fourth segment. We've got some really good stuff here. If you are still listening to my voice, stick around, because we've got some good stuff for the fourth segment. In some ways, we may have saved the best until last. So up to this point, we've been sort of beaten up on the health information technology community. We've been talking about their arrogance. We've been talking about their ignorance. And we've also been talking about the effect of the midterm elections that, you know, with the expected demise of the meaningful use program, and soon within a year or two, no more forces in place of any significance that force providers to buy inferior products, that they're going to be on their own. And if they're going to be on their own, they need to come up with a strategy, and they need to come up with a message that is different than the posture that they are assuming right now towards the healthcare community. But the good news is, the good news for them is that not all parts of the health information technology community have this problem. We've been talking about the mainstream HIT community, the large EMR vendors, the folks that sell companion products for them, those kind of things. We're not talking about the small startups. We're sort of talking about the giants who are selling very traditional products like electronic medical records. But the good news is there is one very important part of the health information technology community that does not suffer from any of these problems. They don't have an ignorance problem. They don't have an arrogance problem. And they're working under a brand new model of how medicine might work in the future. And I think they've got it very close to exactly right in terms of what they're doing. And those of you who are familiar with HIT may be able to guess this, but for everybody else, I'm talking about mHealth. I'm talking about the mobile health sector. These are the people that are selling apps for smartphones. These are the people that are selling these wrist-based, you know, they look just like a rubber band, but actually embedded in that is some electronics that allow some really neat stuff to happen. And within the mobile health community, they're calling this the race to the wrist. Right? How fast can we put sensors on something around your wrist that kind of looks like a watch, but not really, that has all sorts of embedded sensors? I was first exposed to this by accident. I was clueless. And in fact, my position towards mHealth has changed. Back in 2011 when I first learned about it and I was reading all this stuff about Eric Topol and Kathleen Sebelius that I was talking about earlier in the show, I even had a blog post that basically said mHealth is clueless. They're naive. They're a solution in search of a problem. And this really doesn't, people don't need to be wasting their time on this. I will be the first to say I was wrong. And I have changed my mind about what mHealth is all about because they have gotten very smart in the last few years. In fact, in 2012, I talked about 2011, the Mobile Health Summit where all these folks get together. There was a lot of doctor bashing going on there. I actually attended the meeting in 2012, the following year in Washington, and the keynote speakers had a very different message. The director of NIH was there and basically said, look, people, you all need to face reality and show us data that your applications really work. You have to do what the rest of medicine does, which is to set up a study, do the research, get the data, and prove that what you are doing with information technology is safe and effective, just like a drug, just like a surgical procedure, just like anything else in medicine. So a very refreshing thing to see that, between 2011 and 2012, there was a lot of, reinvention of self going on. So the first time that I changed my mind about this was a patient who came in. I had been treating them for acid reflux, which is one of the most common things that an ear, nose, and throat doctor sees. And this was the first follow-up visit. I'd seen him the first time. We talked about diet. We talked about getting rid of alcohol and caffeine and tobacco and chocolate and peanut butter and all that stuff. We're very heavy into the diet stuff. Also gave them some medication as a temporizing measure, and we see them back in 6 weeks, see how they're doing. And I walked in the room, said, sir, how you doing with the reflux? How you doing with that, lump in the throat you had? And he says, oh, I feel much better. I said, well, that's great. Obviously, we never get tired of hearing that as physicians. I said, how do you know that you're better? And he held up his wrist and he said, I've got this thing on my wrist called a Fitbit. And a Fitbit has a motion sensor in it that allows you to monitor your quality of sleep. And I think that makes sense, right? The more tossing and turning you're doing, the more disturbed your sleep is, the more you're going to move around during the night. And the motion sensors and these kinds of devices are going to pick that up. And he said, since my reflux has been treated, I'm sleeping better. And I know I'm sleeping better, not because I feel better and I think I'm sleeping better, but I got hard data out of my Fitbit that shows that my sleep is more restful. I'm not tossing and turning so much. And that just floored me, David. It absolutely floored me. And I was like, wow, this stuff really has a lot of potential. So I decided that last month for my birthday, I was going to get myself one of these. And Microsoft has just come out with a new one. It's called Microsoft Band. And this thing not only does everything that a Fitbit does with heart rate and, skin temperature and, accelerometers and gyrometers and, connectivity and all that stuff, but it also combines all the smartwatch functions. So you get, to answer your texts and look at your calls and all that kind of stuff. And you get all this stuff for a bargain price of about $200, which is an amazingly cheap price, in my opinion, for something that has, at least, 10 sensors on it. 8 of those are actually monitoring either your insides, with heart rate, skin temperature, and something called a galvanometer, and monitoring your outsides with a GPS, a movement sensor, a position sensor, a light sensor, and something I thought was really great, which is an ultraviolet sensor. So if you're athletic and you go outside, this thing monitors your sun exposure and can warn you if you're getting too much, which I think is brilliant. There is one thing that bothered me, though, about reading about all these sensors. So I'm going to put David on the spot here with a question I did not review with him ahead of time. But, David, what do you get if you hook up a heart rate sensor to someone, a galvanometer to them, right, which is skin conductivity, and a skin temperature monitor? If you hook up those three sensors to somebody, what do you have? You have a lie. You have a lie detector.
Yeah.
You have a lie detector. So if you put one of these things, when this thing comes in, I haven't got mine yet because everybody's buying them and I've been waiting about 2 weeks for mine and they can't even tell me when they're coming in. They're selling out so fast. But in essence, you are putting a complete monitor on yourself when you do this. It's almost like these ankle bracelets for people that are, under house arrest.
There's a next question: that who's getting that information?
Well, conceivably everyone, right? This thing Bluetooth to your cell phone. Your cell phone's connected to the cloud, right? As the IT people call it. Connected to the whole world. And not only does this thing, not only does this thing monitor where you are, how fast you're going, what you're doing, and I mean anything, what you're doing, and now it can tell whether you're lying or not, or what you're up to based on some of this galvanometer and skin temperature stuff. This is like having one of those bracelets on for house arrest practically. There's a huge privacy issue there, and strangely enough, nobody seems to mind. I mean, obviously I didn't seem to mind, right? I bought one. So, I don't mean to sound hypocritical, but it is very interesting about the privacy thing. But, getting back to it, we got all these sensors on this thing, and there's more coming. There's going to be blood glucose is coming, blood pressure's coming, probably pulse oximetry measuring your blood oxygen level is coming. And then all the, connectivity to every single, a fitness app that you can find. And then here's the shocking part, David. As if this smartwatch Fitbit thing doesn't do everything else, you know what else it does? It tells time. You can actually set it so it looks like a wristwatch. You can just look at it and see what time it is.
I bet it's digital, not analog.
Oh, I'll bet you they'd probably put an analog face on it if you wanted to. But yes, it probably is digital. No question about it. So in the last 5 minutes of the show, I want to talk about why this mHealth thing is so exciting. It's not so much because of the toys. It's not so much because of this, neat little thing with lights and a tiny little screen and all that kind of stuff. It's the model. It's the economic model that mobile health is operating under, and there's four key points that really drive this home. Number one, minimal, if any, federal regulations regulating how these devices are designed, how they're sold. There's no FDA approval for these devices as long as they don't get too ambitious, as long as they're not actually giving medical advice, and all they're doing is reporting your blood pressure, heart rate, blood sugar, motion, that kind of stuff, and they're not giving medical advice, then the FDA has ruled, at least for the moment, that they are not going to regulate that stuff. That's huge. That's huge, because the FDA approval process adds a huge amount of expense to building, a new drug, a new device, whatever it is that you're trying to do. And so this is wide open. And the vendors are embracing this as wide open. If you go to the website for the Microsoft Band, right, this wrist device that I just ordered, haven't received yet, you will find that it is connected to an online service called Microsoft Health. And if you follow the link and you go to Microsoft Health, what you find, in my opinion, is a very honest sort of open approach to how this is going to work. And they freely admit up front, we have this device. We're not really sure of everything it does. We know that the bare minimum, the stuff that it does today, makes it worth $200 to buy. And I agree with that. But they've got sensors on this thing that there's not even any software written for, right? I don't know that there's any software apps written for a skin galvanometer, but again, no regulations in this industry. That's why you can buy this stuff dirt cheap. On the other side, in the EMR space, right, meaningful use government regulations killed innovation, right? EMR vendors have no interest in true innovation. They only have an interest in government compliance. On the mHealth side, with Fitbits and Microsoft Bands, you got the complete opposite. You got wide open, no interest or need for government compliance. All the brain power goes to innovation. That's great. Number two, direct-to-consumer business, no third-party payer, no insurance, no politics to get Medicare to pay for it or Blue Cross or Blue Shield, and that's why the device only costs $200 and not $1,000. Number three, these things have a focus on wellness, right? How often is medicine criticized? Or you don't care about people till they're sick. Reasonable criticism, these things now look at wellness. And finally, number four, these devices support a strategy that is, we're running out of time, I'm going too fast, that this is a bottom-up strategy instead of a top-down strategy. These folks are very smart. They know they sell their products cheap, they make them simple, they make the ambitions reasonable, not impossible, and so they're selling these things like hotcakes. We're at the end of the show. I need to sign off. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
This is America's Web Radio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.